Welcome back to The Rate of Change with York Wealth Management. As advisors to some of the wealthiest families in the country, The Rate of Change is a podcast designed to help you in the pursuit of building long-term wealth through the insights of some of the brightest minds in asset management. I'm your host, Murdoch Gaddy, and in today's Rockcast, we're joined by Ryan Bass, founder and managing director of Pangen Capital. Ryan brings deep experience from the institutional investment world, having spent 16 years at UniSuper, where he oversaw more than $8 billion in property transactions across direct real estate, unlisted property funds, and listed A-REITs. Earlier in his career, he also helped establish MCS Property, one of Australia's original syndicators, and was one of the founding six behind iSelect before choosing to focus on funds management and institutional real estate. Could you imagine being one of the founders of iSelect? It's massive. At The Rate of Change, I must say we love conversations with entrepreneurs who have operated at the highest level and are now stepping out to solve a real problem they've seen up close. Ryan's new venture, Pangen Capital, is doing just that. After decades inside a major super fund, he observed a key issue. Some of the best performing, most stable property assets in the country, like core shopping centers, CBD tower office towers, and logistics hubs, are largely inaccessible to wholesale investors. These institutional grade opportunities are typically locked behind $10 million minimums, strict mandates, and a relationship-based entry. Through Pangen's new fund of funds, the Pangen Australian Real Estate Fund, PAREF, Ryan is now making those opportunities available to wholesale investors. The fund will target returns of 8 to 10% per annum, exposure to diversified unlisted property funds managed by some managers such as Dexus, GPT, Charter Hall, and Lendlease, and a structure designed for monthly unit pricing and quarterly income. PAREF aims to deliver quality, stable, and long-term performance with the flexibility to expand across other high-caliber managers as opportunities arise. This is about bringing institutional-grade real estate to investors who have historically been unable to access it, which I quite like. In this conversation, please join us as Ryan breaks down how the strategy works, why now is such an attractive time in the real estate cycle, and how his fund is positioned to benefit from the repricing in property markets, good old-fashioned surging population, and tightening supply of premium commercial assets. We also touch on the fund's mechanics, risk management, the importance of manager independence, and what Ryan learned deploying capital at the massive scale he did inside UniSuper. So before we get into the conversation, please remember this Rockcast is made for entertainment purposes only. I encourage you to listen to the disclaimer at the end of the Rockcast and keep your feedback coming. You can reach me at mgatti@ywm.com.au. If you have any questions about the podcast, you want to learn more, any of the guests that we've had on, or how they may best work with your investment policy, please give me a call and York Wealth Management will happily work with you solving those problems. With that being said, I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Ryan Bass from Pangen. Welcome to The Rate of Change with York Wealth Management.
Thank you, and it's great to be here. Thanks, Murdoch.
Great to have you on. I'm really glad, a mutual colleague, suggested to have a chat with you. I find what you're doing and your background really quite interesting. So why don't we kick things off like we always do and tell us a little bit about, who is Ryan Bass and, how you got into finance?
No, thank you, Murdoch. And it's an interesting journey. I as a kid, I always thought I would get into IT. I was very much in that space. However, I got an opportunity to do essentially computer science and law when I was at uni. And when I was at uni, I met and started working for a fellow called Julius Coleman, who was one of the founders of MCS Property, which was one of the original and largest property syndicators in the country. So he had a legal background, but he started essentially buying shopping centers for people to invest in. He'd buy a few shopping centers, put a fund together. It was extraordinarily successful because he essentially, bought well, and he looked after the investors, and he looked after the assets really well. And that grew to be one of the largest property syndicators. This was probably in the 90s. So I sort of did my articles and then moved straight into property funds management. I was very much more a numbers person using my sort of IT background, but the legal background was very useful as well. So when I moved into MCS Property, we worked on a range of different we did acquisitions. It was a big team. We did some M&A activity and fundraising, a whole range of activities. At the time, we were also working on essentially a fund of funds called the Direct Property Fund. That there was a whole range of syndicates, and this fund would sit on top and invest into the underlying syndicates. And then when there was a listed company, basically MCS's largest competitor, Centro, basically acquired MCS in 2003. So I moved over and I became the fund manager of that fund of funds, the Centro Direct Property Fund, which grew to be a $2 billion fund of funds invested across all their syndicates. And we targeted financial planners and family offices, instos, etc. And it was also listed on the platforms like the Netwealths and the Hubs and in those days, the Macquarie Wraps, the BT Wraps, those sort of larger groups. So I then moved to UniSuper in 2008. And I guess from there, and I became I was joined as a senior member of the investment team in the property space. And from there, firstly, it was an incredible transition to move from essentially mainly in shopping centres and the smaller end of town to really sort of the big institutional capital. I mean, UniSuper now is a $150 billion fund. It was about $25 billion when I joined. And we're involved across all sectors, office, retail, industrial. We invested in direct properties. We developed direct properties. We invested in these institutional grade unlisted funds and also A-REITs. I was an active A-REIT manager for the last 10 years of my 16 years at UniSuper. So there's a quick, I guess, snapshot of my career. I think it's probably worth mentioning when I was at UniSuper, I was involved in or managed over $8 billion of equity transactions. So that's, buying assets, selling assets, investing into funds, and also through the A-REITs, listed property as well.
Yeah, so that's fun. Lots to unpack there. Like I was saying, I love guys and girls that come on that have not a straight path into finance. Like, isn't it interesting? Hey, like you do tech, you do law, and then you're like, oh, that may have been a waste of time. You fast forward all the way to today, and tech is so freaking important. And then when it comes down to contracts, like something, if everyone's out there studying law and go, I want to become a lawyer, consider essentially financial services, because it's just contract heavy, isn't it? Right? Yeah, everything's a deal. Everything's a contract. Everything's the fine print. Right? And then the efficiencies of IT, it's amazing how they both work hand in hand, isn't it? Have you found
absolutely.
That?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think my sort of IT and data background, actually, I've got a bit of an entrepreneurial background. I was one of the founders of iSelect back in the...
You buried the lead there. You were one of the founders of iSelect?
Yeah, so essentially in the late 90s, I got together with a group of people to, workshop some ideas, and it was the tech boom at the time, and we basically came up with that product, with that company, and I didn't stay there too long because I was focused on my property fund sort of career. But I was one of the, I think it was the one of the original six who went off. And as we know, Damien Waller, he ended up sort of running that company and did very well out of it from his part. So yeah, I've got a bit of an entrepreneurial sort of background and I do enjoy a bit of tech. But to answer your question, I think IT and law and having a good sort of, I've been very sort of quantitative as well. I think that they're sort of good combinations for investing in any space, because you can use that legal and IT or that sort of data background to essentially assist you with your investment decision processes and your thinking.
Yeah, brilliant. We'll get on to Pan Gen Capital, what you're doing now, for a sec. Just I want to lean into this a bit more. So you mentioned you hit the private side, you know, with all the shopping centers, you know, that doing the private transactions, which yes. I would guess you had a little bit more, you know, leniency because, you know, smaller group of people. You know, what's it like? I've never actually had a great conversation with someone that's actually, you know, being able to choose the investments we go into the major super funds on the property side. Like, how does that process work? Like, what I'm getting at, is it substantially more regulated? Is there the criteria a lot more difficult, or are you finding that the group has a relied upon number of, you know, groups, I don't know, CBRE or someone of the equivalent, where you get constant deal flow through and it's more like you can only deal with these particular people, or you must lend 7 or 8 times to someone to get a track record of these people before you consider the equity piece? Because a lot of people that listen to this podcast, we've had a lot of great people for private credit and property on four. There's probably people listening to this going, you know, we would love to have a crack at, you know, getting into the ilks of UniSuper. But what's the process? Like, how do you consider a deal? Like, how does someone present a transaction? Because that's, for me, that's just mind-blowing. Because you're around $8 billion. You oversaw $8 billion worth of acquisitions.
Of UniSuper. Transactions.
Transactions. Yeah. That's huge.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And when I started at UniSuper, there was just basically two of us in the property team. There was obviously a larger investment team, and we would rely heavily on existing relationships and managers. But essentially, you know, we would see hundreds of deals come across our desk, every year. I guess you sort of get a feel for the type of deals that you looking for and the type of structures that you're looking for. So, our sort of experience and our relationships with managers. And I think UniSuper had a pretty interesting structure from its property side as well. We had a mandate with a group, AMP Capital, and they would run their direct, the direct asset. So often there would be deals that would come up, and we would ask the AMP Capital transactions team to essentially run the numbers or do all the due diligence on the direct deals. But occasionally there were a lot of, you know, fund deals that we would look at as well, in investment funds. And that was our sort of expertise or speciality in assessing various funds. And essentially we had filters. Is it the right does it have the right assets that we want to target, the right quality assets? Is it in the right type of structure that we're happy with, that gives us as the investor the right sort of controls, and also is it the right manager? So in some ways it's a fairly simple philosophy, getting the right assets in the right structure with the right manager.
Hearing that, your background's predominantly been less on, you know, finding out whether or not you want to specifically purchase a shopping center, or specifically purchase, you know, one particular office building or, you know, an industrial complex, right? So not specifically a transaction. You're saying that your main many years of experience has been on assessing the acquisition of fund managers to essentially capture a basket in a particular property and a subcategory, you know, asset class. Is that what you're saying? Like the $8 billion which you oversaw, was that purchasing fund of funds, or were you physically going out and buying, you know, a new Woolworths goes in and you're looking at that large development, or, you know, the new airport's going in Sydney, you know, you're looking at essentially purchasing that and then managing that, or the Sunshine Airport. You know what I mean? I'm just trying to get an idea of...
I think it was a combination of those. I mean, with direct deals, we would tend to, vet the deals initially. And if there was interest, then we might sort of use our managers. Like at the time, our direct manager was AMP Capital, or we'd use other managers to essentially do the heavy lifting in terms of the due diligence and legal and negotiations. However, you know, we'd always sort of sit at the top and, you know, make sure that the deal sort of worked for our members.
Nice. Like, when I was at university, like yourself, I did a Bachelor of Design in Computing, thought it was a waste of time. That's why I'm laughing about it, just saying how funny is it? You do a degree and then you fast forward and it's just pretty much everything's tech, right? But I was in the architecture facility, and the funniest thing about architecture is, you know, you look back in your career with all my friends, there's always one building or one deal that someone's done. You go, I did that, you know, when you're telling your kids, your grandkids. So from your days at UniSuper, you know, what deal, what property essentially, what got built that you go, you know, that was awesome? What was your favorite?
Wow, there's a lot to think about there. Probably one of the most interesting deals that really occurred over probably the better part of a decade was UniSuper co-owned Karrinup Shopping Centre with Westfield. With Westfield Group, that's, you know, one of the biggest shopping centers in Perth, and ultimately it ended up that and that shopping center was managed by AMP Capital, and ultimately Westfield wanted a management role. In the end, that property, in order to work out the structure of the ownership structure, it ended up going to the High Court, essentially UniSuper sort of won that case, and then essentially bought out the Westfield stake, and then from there it was able to undertake an $800 or $900 million development for that asset, which I would say now is without doubt the best shopping centre in Perth by a country mile. It's kind of the Chadston of Perth, so to speak, and it's an absolutely brilliant asset. So I think that was a pretty amazing deal that we did for that UniSuper property team did for its members.
That's pretty cool.
Went to the High Court and then ended up, you know, doing an $800 million development.
Love it. I love it. So Pangen Capital, when did it begin? Who's Pangen Capital? What's the philosophy behind it? What are you trying to achieve? You know, what's happening with Pangen Capital?
Sure. So I guess when I moved to UniSuper, I was blown away by the quality of assets that a big institution like UniSuper can get access to. And compared to what smaller investors, presume like yourself and I, can get access to, incredibly different type of quality type structures. One of the areas that UniSuper and a lot of these big institutions invest in is called the unlisted property funds. They're institutional grade unlisted property funds run by managers such as Charter Hall and Dexus and GPT, Lendlease, ISPT. And these funds have been operating for decades. They own, honestly, some of the best commercial property that you can buy in Australia, because they've amassed these portfolios over decades. They've curated them, they've developed them, and these funds are simply not available to small investors, because typically you need $10 million or more to get into them. And I always thought, well, why can't small investors get access to these incredible funds? to my knowledge, this is not really available to small investors. So essentially, this is something I've been thinking about for many years, and that's why when I started PanGen, I wanted to almost like democratize these incredible funds by creating a fund of funds that allows smaller investors access to these institutional grade property funds.
For people not familiar with a fund of funds, what is a fund of funds?
It's a pretty simple structure in the sense that it's a fund that aggregates or pools capital from investors to then invest into other funds. So in this case, our fund invests in these institutional grade funds that collectively own almost $100 billion of prime grade commercial property, that's shopping centers, great logistics assets and office buildings. And there's about 60 or 70 billion of equity in these funds. They've been, as I said, operating for decades, and traditional investors have been the groups like UniSuper of the world.
What's the ticket size to get into these?
Typically $10 million, but it's not just the ticket size. These funds, you need to go through fairly strict criteria to ensure that they maintain their there's a number of sort of technical reasons, but their qualified status for the investors, which there's a few sort of hurdles, and it's not just a big ticket size to get into them.
That's what I was trying to work out. Like, so everyone knows we use NetWealth. Some of our friends use, you know, Mason Stevens, Premium, you know, other very Hub24, good platforms, right? You know, and they do have like a lot of access to, you know, high grade property portfolios. But, you know, some families have got $10, $20, $30 million, you know, essentially, you know, sitting there with some of these funds, or $100 million, right? So if you've got $100 million in an account, you're an ultra high net worth, you know, Australian investor, you know, the question they're probably asking is, well, I've got $10 million, you know, why can't I via NetWealth? And NetWealth is an institution, you know, the money's held under custody. You know, why can't, and look, it's just, I'm just essentially, you know, asking the question that everyone's asking, right? Why can't I access, you know, these transactions? Are you saying that based on the criteria, they actually just physically can't? Or like, what is the opportunity? Is this like literally like a boys club, as in you can't get in unless, or if you have the money and you're via an institution, you can, and there's a workaround? That's what I'm trying to understand.
I think it's about not just the check size and also complying with the entry criteria of these funds, but it's also understanding how they operate as well. You can't just simply go in and out of the funds. You got to understand how the liquidity mechanisms work. Some of these funds have preemptives in terms of when they're raising equity, if you want to sell units. So I think it's not just the ability to get into these funds, but it's the ability to understand how they operate. And as I said, they're not simply ATMs. You can't get in or out very easily. You've got to understand how the liquidity mechanisms work as well. So it doesn't suit a lot of investors who aren't institutions or understand how these funds operate.
Right. So, okay, so that's on that side, but why don't we just discuss what the actual opportunity here? So, what the fund itself is the PanGen Australian Real Estate Fund, PARF. So
PARF, yeah.
PARF. PARF. So, can we just unpack the fund, how it's structured, the mechanics of?
Absolutely.
Because you're mentioning, you know, the actual underlying allocation, which you're going to make, is a whole bunch of restrictions. But, you know, what are the duration restrictions, the target returns, like what are the mechanics of this fund?
No, absolutely. So the investment strategy of the fund is to invest in these underlying real estate funds that are essentially core real estate funds. What does core mean? It means established, income-producing, prime-grade real estate with limited development. Okay, so you're not taking a lot of development risk. You're buying assets such as Gateway in Sydney, let's say that's the Dexus Fund. You're buying potentially High Point Shopping Centre in Melbourne. You're buying some really prime logistics assets. And as I said, with limited development, there's always a bit of development in these funds. So our fund essentially offers, and the underlying funds are really, they've got very high governance levels and low gearing. High governance means that, there's really good alignment between the investors and the managers. There's a really good transparency, so investors can get, you know, really good access to the information and to the fund managers of these funds. And pricing, part of the governance is the pricing of these funds. Many of the funds are actually pricing the underlying assets. They get a full valuation very frequently. Some of them even value the entire portfolio every quarter externally, which you know, gives investors a lot of comfort that the pricing is sound. These funds also tend to price monthly. So essentially, our fund will take the pricing of the underlying funds on a monthly basis, and will be a monthly. Our fund will be priced on a monthly basis. Generally, the underlying funds pay quarterly distributions, so we'll be paying quarterly distributions as well, and there'll be a sort of reinvestment ability as well into our fund. So I think that's kind of at a high level sort of how these work. Now, in terms of how we construct the portfolio, we essentially like our fund to be diversified across the main three food groups of retail, industrial, and office, and across a number of managers. So we're getting good diversification by properties and by managers and sectors.
What's the performance been on these funds, and what are you targeting?
So our target return is a total return of 8-10% over the medium to long term. And why we came up with that sort of target return essentially starts with how the underlying properties are valued, the expectation of what the properties will deliver on an ungeared basis, and then that's basically, you know, the income with a bit of rental growth. There could be some development upside or some refurbishment upside. So that creates an ungeared return. These funds are conservatively geared, so our model portfolio targets probably 20-25% gearing. So that adds a little bit of return on top of that, less the fees of the underlying funds, and our fees comes to a target return. We would have 8-10%.
What are your fees on it, and what are their fees?
Okay, so our fees are 0.6% of NAV plus costs, and then there's a performance fee of essentially 15% above a fixed 9% return hurdle. So we believe that the fee structure in our fund is highly competitive in the marketplace. We also the underlying funds, because they're massive institutional funds, and obviously institutional investors are very fee sensitive, the underlying fees are, let's say, circa around sort of 60 basis points on a NAV basis. So when you layer up our fees and their fees, it's probably around 1.3, which and I think the key difference is that and this is probably what I haven't mentioned, but I think a lot of investors recognize this. These underlying funds have held the properties, a lot of their portfolio for sometimes for decades. So they've kind of written off all the acquisition costs, like stamp duty, let's call it 6%. So essentially, when you're entering into many of these funds, you're entering in essentially at NAV. So, you know, let's say that, 6% stamp duty over a 10-year period would add, let's call it 60 or 70 basis points of additional return to your ungeared return when you don't sort of pay those acquisition costs. So that is a real benefit. And I think, you know, people need to think about fees and costs as well.
Got it. So the opportunity is to get access to something that you generally can't, right? In a format that's simple and easy that can essentially fit in a platform. That's pretty much the gist of it. And who are the main competitors in this space that you're going up against? There has to be one or two or someone that's, you know, what's the expression in university? If you have an idea, chances are someone else has had it. So you go find their idea and go, what did they do wrong? And then you evolve from there. That's university. Welcome to uni.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't believe there's a product like this on the market, and I'm quite surprised about that. I'd know that there's been a few of the underlying managers who have tried to put together structures that allow smaller investors access to these institutional sort of grade funds. The problem with a manager doing that is that they'll tend to obviously be beholden to their funds. So I think that's a key difference with our product, is that we're not beholden to any manager. We're going to simply invest based on the best funds that we can find at the time, whether it's a Dexus fund or GPT fund or Lendlease fund or Mervac fund or the like. So it has been tried, you know, I think managers have tried it in the past but there's nothing really that I can think of that is similar to this fund. It really is quite a unique product in the marketplace. And I guess it brings together my skills of running a fund of funds as well as being an institutional property investor. It kind of blends those two together.
That makes a lot of sense. But to your point, regarding it gives you the capacity to choose which funds to be in at the right time when you want to do it, right? You're kicking off this fund with targeting three main fund allocations, right?
Correct.
So what are the three funds? Why don't we just start with one? We'll go through them, because if I ask three, we kind of forget whether you're second or third is.
Sure.
So what's the first one? And, you know, what's the macroeconomic rationale and rhyme and reason for that? Because I heard, why don't we begin with Dexus? Because, you know, I use that building, which essentially, and like out of all the buildings in, you know, office space, you know, I find it very interesting that you chose that building and you've got the capacity to go all the way across Australia and you've chosen Sydney. Right. And then ever since we've had COVID, we've had the GFC, we've had, you know, occupancy rates down on office space. Right. So why specifically the Dexus portfolio and targeting, you know, that building? I find that, you know, that quite interesting.
Yeah. So firstly, there's in the institutional property fund space, there's I think 15 or 20 of these funds. They own about $100 billion of property, circa 60 to 70 bill of equity. So there's probably about five or six funds that we really like and we want to target initially. And the Dexus Wholesale Property Fund is definitely one of those funds that we like. It's a diversified portfolio. It's actually got almost $13 billion of assets, of property assets, almost 50 properties, and the office building, and it's across office, retail, and industrial. So one of the office assets is Gateway, which is the building you're in.
Right. So sorry, my apologies. Yeah, because I thought you were saying that essentially Dexus has got a number of vehicles in which, you know, one is just that office building. So this is a fund which has 50 of Dexus's office
almost
buildings
50.
In it.
Well, okay. It's not just office. It's also retail. It's got Westfield shopping centers like Westfield Miranda. It's got, you know, it's doing some developments like the Waterfront Place development in Brisbane. It's got some really great logistics assets, like there's a big industrial estate in Melbourne called Ravenhall that it's developed and had a really great sort of returns to investors for that. So it's really a high quality diverse diversified portfolio with a great manager and some really great assets. And you know, one of the assets is Gateway, and in particular, I do like that the Dexus Fund. Overall, its asset quality is very good, and its office assets like Gateway and Key Quarter Tower, Waterfront Place, they had some of the best office buildings in the best locations in the country.
What's happening with the office space market? Is it a do you have to are some doing better than others? Like, you know, I've noticed that there's always a discount running around Sydney CBD of people trying to get bums on seats in particular buildings, but others are, you know, they're always a full occupancy. I think the new Salesforce towers come out, et cetera, et cetera. What's happening in that space?
So I think office has definitely been hit really hard with COVID. And ultimately, you've got to be really selective in which office assets you want to own. You want to own Gateway in the city, in the, you know, the heart of the CBD precinct in Sydney, or Key Quarter Tower, or Waterfront Place, or you want to be on the Paris end of Collins Street, like 80 Collins Street. Those are the places where tenants want to be. They're great office towers, and you know, the investment bankers, the lawyers, the accountants, the rainmakers, they want to be there, and that's where the staff want to be. So, and they've got the right amenity in the right location. Where you've got to be a bit careful of is to is kind of the lower quality assets, office buildings, it's the B and C grade assets, or even the A grade assets, but in the wrong parts of town. People just don't want to be there. You don't want to be necessarily down parts of St Kilda Road or down parts of Docklands in Melbourne. So I think it's kind of you ask a lot of office owners, and it's all about bifurcation. There's the haves and the have-nots, and you really want to be where you want to be in the locations and the properties where people want to be, and that's very much the case with office.
It's quite interesting what's happening. I really want to get into interest rates and the impact of the cutting. And then it's absolutely what's happening with tariffs in the States and, you know, the whole dollar and all the fun stuff. But before I do, then I forget, what's the second investment you're looking at and why?
So we've got a number of funds that we're targeting. I also like the, for example, the GPT Wholesale Shopping Centre Fund. Okay. So that fund, it's got about $3.5 billion of shopping centres. Its biggest and probably best quality asset is High Point Shopping Centre in Melbourne. That's in the western suburbs of Melbourne, strongly growing catchment, and it's got 420 retailers. That centre is effectively full. There's tenants in there, the retailers in there who want to expand, and there's retailers not in that centre who want to get in. So that's a pretty good place if you're a landlord. And I think that centre has got a very long and good runway for growth. It's got near-term opportunities, refurbishment, but it's probably got longer-term sort of opportunities to build more retail space, and possibly there might be even mixed use. So that fund is also recently acquired Rouse Hill Town Centre in the western suburbs of Sydney, very strongly growing catchment as well. The manager is actually doing a $200 million development on that asset currently. The GPT fund owns half of that. So there'll be some development profits that'll sort of flow through into that fund as that development completes and de-risks. And I think that's one of the key elements of a lot of these funds, that you're buying established income producing properties, but there's always opportunities to add value through development.
And door number three?
Number three, we like industrial, we like logistics, and there's two really great logistics funds that we've been looking at. One of them is the Lendlease APPF Industrial Fund. That's got over 40 properties. It's got a really exceptional portfolio of infill logistics locations. The manager's a very sort of strong manager. That fund's been, I think, running since the 90s. So it's continually curated the portfolio. And the other fund we like in the industrial space is the Charter Hall Prime Industrial Fund. Now, this is a massive $12 billion in a logistics portfolio. It started, I think, in 2007. It's developed a lot of its own assets, and I guess one of the differences to being, you know, what we often see with property developers, these core funds are, when they develop, they essentially build to own or develop to core, essentially. So they would sometimes acquire land, go through the process of zoning, develop the properties, and the profits will be actually will be kept by investors, and the investors in the fund will then own that asset as a core asset. So I think that's one of the key differences as well with these funds. They often build core products for the benefit of their members, rather than trying to, you know, buy some land, do the development, and then flog it off and do the next the next product. And I think that process actually is very efficient as well, from a, let's call it a stamp duty sort of perspective. You know, you're buying the land and then you're developing, and then you sort of keep the profits within the fund. So I think that those two funds I really like in the industrial space.
So when you say industrial, what specifically is underneath that? Like, are we talking, you know, ports? Are we talking, you know, like Amazon-style warehouses? You having a crack at the airports? Like, you know, what are we doing here? Or are these like the light industrial? Like, are you having to go at North Harbour? Like, you know what I mean? Like, what does it mean when these people say industrial?
So I think that the newer version is called logistics. They're essentially these big sheds, often on
like the Amazon style sheds. Yeah. You cut like right now up Queensland way, you know, pretty much from Brisbane or Gold Coast all the way up to this, you know, Noosa. You've got, you know, everyone's rotated out of Sydney to Melbourne and gone and then taken a job. And they're just practically every bit of farmland's being converted into some form of light industrial or heavy industrial or a shopping center or Crestmead or Ipswich. Woolworths is landing there. Is it that type of stuff?
Look, it's more the larger logistics warehouses or sheds. I mean, they can range from, you know, let's call it, you know, 10 or 20,000 square meters to, you know, 80 to 100,000 square meters, which is huge. You think about, you know, like an 80,000, I've been into an 80,000 square meter shed. There's a Woolies distribution center, I think, in Melbourne, and that's just absolutely, you know, gigantic. And it so it's those type of assets that they would target as essentially logistics assets. However, some of the properties I've been in, there's been I think steelworks, there's been you know, true industrial type uses as well, but a lot of these are logistics assets where, you know, goods get shipped in, like an Amazon warehouse. It gets held in the warehouse and then distributed out.
Yeah, which is pretty much the backbone. It's pretty much the backbone of, you know, how everything works these days, right? You got a main distribution hub that's 80,000 square meters, and then you got the smaller ones, 20, you know, to essentially decrease the time, which holds smaller amount of stock, so everything moves around.
It's kind of the hub and spoke model that logistics groups use. You're right.
In China, it's down to, I think, you know, an hour. There's like an hour between every one. Like here, it's a couple of hours. But I'm just, do you reckon that essentially we're going to go the path of China and all these hubs are just going to kind of get closer to close, like nodules, you know, connecting and making things quicker and more efficient?
Well, I think yes. I think that's a likely outcome, and that hub and spoke model is probably the, you know, where some of these groups will have, you know, that massive distribution center with the smaller centers closer to the consumer in the infill. And I think that's, you know, having the mix of those assets, you know, there's really big sheds and then the smaller sheds in infill locations is probably a good strategy. And both those funds that I talk about, you know, they sort of complement each other in some ways.
What, how's the contracts work? So are these being built, like, fine, let me rephrase. When a deal's done, are they building the train tracks, hoping a train comes, or are they getting, you know, essentially a contract or a tender from, you know, say Woolworths or Amazon, you know, requesting them to find space to build in a particular and help us find a deal? Like, how are these, and then essentially they take the tenancy? Like, what are these transactions?
So I think when you're probably talking about a new development of a shed.
Yeah, so there's a new thing. Or no, it might not be new. So there's something currently existing. What I'm trying to understand is the property itself, you know, with essentially the logistics shed, you know, who owns it? Is it a JV? Is it a lease agreement? You know, like, and where are we going to be going with this is essentially the risks associated to, you know, if the market takes a hit, you know, we get another COVID event, you know, and everyone has to work from home again. You know, what does, I'm just trying to understand, how are these, because people don't really think about the risks and rewards based on these types of questions, but you're talking about, you know, bond rate over in the States just caught, they tried to cut it from 5 down to 4, and then the Chinese said no, and it was the largest trading day in bonds we've ever seen in our entire life, just shook markets. If things change, which are happening at a, you know, regimes are changing on a global scale, and potentially the domestic impacts, right, of those changes can greatly impact the consumer nature and thus the credit markets and just have like a domino impact on these particular assets. And when looking at them, I'm just trying to understand, you can get a very good idea of potentially how something may be impacted depending on how the contracts were agreed, on the way in, and who's essentially the tenancy, which is paying the bill to ensure that these things don't have a problem. So I'm just trying to get an idea, since you've been looking at these quite heavily, like, you know, how, what are these things? How are these things contracted?
Yeah. So let's take an example of, let's say there's the Lendlease Fund owns a 20,000 square meter shed in Truganina in Melbourne, and that's got a 5-year lease to Toll Holdings. Yeah, I don't know if that's the case. I'm just sort of making it up. So regardless of what happens to tariffs or Trump, you know, there's still a lease in place between Toll and the owner of that building, and Toll, being a, you know, corporate, has to pay the rent until the term expires. Okay. The key thing is when that shed, when there's an expiry coming up, then obviously the landlord needs to negotiate with the tenant about whether they renew or whether that tenant goes to another place. But generally, the rental terms depend on the market conditions, so the economic growth the economic growth, is that shed the right sort of shed for that tenant? Is it in the right location? Does it have the right amenity? Does it have the right access to transport? And also that tenant will sort of think carefully about the cost of moving its facility from that shed to another shed. So there's a whole lot of things that go into the mix when there's a re-leasing deal taking place. Generally, you know, as I said, if you've got a shed that's leased to a corporate for 5 or 10 years, that income, that rental income is going to be very stable, and it's very unlikely with these you know, large tenants that they're simply, you know, going to default.
Oh no, I hear what you're saying, and that makes a lot of sense. What I'm trying to work out is, in their portfolio, is a what percentage of the portfolio do they own outright? What I'm trying to understand is, do they own 100% outright, and then everything is essentially a lease agreement which they have to work out?
Yep.
Or are there deals where essentially it might be a JV with Amazon, where it's a 50-50 JV because they can't be asked building it, but they want to essentially – what I'm trying to work out is, because if it's 100% leased out and those things, you know, end or, you know, the winds change, then you have an asset potentially that might not be leased, which is exactly what we're seeing in Sydney CBD. People thought that everyone's going to go to work for Sydney CBD for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
COVID happened, work from home, the capacity to just work out a noosa and not care and still run an empire. I'm just saying, when things change, like these contracts, do they own them 100% or they're part owned, or what's the structure?
So it depends on the fund. So most industrial assets typically have a lower ticket size. So, and many of these funds own, let's say that Truganina shed, it'll own it 100%, might be a $30 or $40 million shed, or, you know, when it comes to the very large assets, sometimes there's a joint venture. They might, like, let's say the Charter Hall Fund might have it might own 50% of that shed with maybe another Charter Hall vehicle or another investor. So there's generally a separation between the property owners, the landlords, and the tenants. So you tend not to have many tenants owning or these big corporate tenants owning part of the shed, because, you know, their return on equity is based on their business. They've got a different return hurdle than owning property. It's kind of they'd rather just simply be a tenant and pay the rent rather than get access the returns of property.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I love these types of conversations. You know, you see something and then you keep, you know, peeling the layers of the onion back. It's like, okay, what's really underneath this? Because what's the Buffett's expression? You'll see if someone's swimming naked when the tide goes out.
That's
and
right.
You never know. Look, on the risks front, a lot's changing in the macro landscape, as I brought up before. Where are we, I suppose, in the cycle of these large industrial, commercial, shopping, you know, essentially, office space buildings? What part of the cycle are we in?
So I think we're actually in an extremely attractive cycle for buying prime grade Australian real estate for a number of reasons. Number one is these assets have repriced significantly. If you could wind back the clock, let's say 3 years, where interest rates were at record lows, the yields or the cap rates of these properties were also at record lows. To give you an idea, our target portfolio, the cap rate or yield of the target portfolio in our target portfolio is about 5.7%. That's essentially the yield of the properties. If you wind the clock back, let's call it 3 years, that similar portfolio would have been priced at around 4.5% to 4.75% on a yield basis. So the yields have blown out significantly. In fact, we've seen, particularly with office, we've seen some office buildings down 15-20% or more in value. And then you think about where we are in the cycle. We've already seen two interest rate cuts, and obviously falling interest rates is a really positive sign for property, because it lowers the interest expense of owners. It changes the equation for buyers. There might be some buyers who are happy to now use a bit more debt. And as a result, we're actually seeing increasing property transaction activity in these properties as well. I mean, to give you an idea, would have been a month or two ago, a Japanese investor, Daibiru, just bought a $600 million, spent $600 million on a big office tower in Sydney.
I saw that. Apparently, it was the biggest transaction for a very long time.
Yeah, and I think more recently, Investor, which is has recently transacted as well. So there's also been increasing interest in logistics. There's been a lot of interest over the past few years, and that's increasing as well. And also retail, we're seeing a number of shopping centres transact as well. So the stabilizing interest rate environment, more attractive pricing, and increasing property transaction activity, they tend to be good signs for the outlook of how properties are priced going forward. So that's on the one side. On the other side, we're actually believe that there's good property fundamentals for the really high quality assets. So for example, occupancy in high quality shopping centers like High Point and also the very high quality industrial assets is extremely high, getting close to 97, 98, sometimes 99% occupancy. And we're also seeing good and growing strong occupancy for the right sort of office assets like the Gateway Towers in Sydney and the Key Quarter Towers and in Brisbane and to a lesser extent Melbourne. I think Melbourne's lagging a bit. So if you're getting the right assets, you're getting good occupancy. And then you've got the supply outlook. The outlook for new supply is lower than it was in past. So and that's because as you're probably aware, it's really expensive to build. Construction costs, development costs are so high. So that's putting a lid on new supply. Then that offsets with we've got population growth. There's still more and more people coming to live in Australia. I think CBRE, which is a major property group, they predict that over 4 million new people will be living in Australia over the next 10 years. And that's going to drive significant demand for new space. I mean, across all sectors, resi, healthcare.
Did you say 4 million in 10 years?
That's CBRE's prediction, 15%.
Yeah, I think the Doge ran an analysis and used Australia as a case study. I think they just released this week that last year alone on our population is 33 or 34 million. We had a million inflows last year, so we grew by a mil. So based on those numbers, if nothing changes, I think they're actually indicating that at a bare minimum, we potentially grow by 10 million in the next 10 years. And that's not including birth rate. That's purely just new inhabitants coming in.
Yeah, and that's going to drive a lot of demand for space. So you've got sort of the you've got demand for space, and it's expensive to build. And I mean, to put some numbers into that, when you're looking at industrial, CBRE predict that for every person who comes, a new person who lives in Australia, that drives demand, that creates an incremental 4.5 square meters of space. Putting that into numbers, that's like building 950 MCG playing fields of new sheds over the next 10 years. And that's a pretty big number. In retail, that's like building and retail, they're saying for every new person you need about an office, about 0.8 of a square meter of new space. So in retail, that's like building 14 new Chadstone shopping centers or 25 Bondi Junctions over the next 10 years. That's a lot of retail space to build. And then you put that in an office context, that's like building 40 new 101 Collins Street Towers or 45 Chifley Towers over the next 10 years. So we think, given the high occupancy of high quality buildings and the population growth and the fact that supply it's hard to build new stuff, we think that is a good macro environment for strong solid rental growth going forward into the medium to long term.
Yeah, it's very interesting what's happening with the new changes that are coming in as well regarding bans on residents. The international capital coming in, you have to be a resident to purchase. Do you reckon that's going to slow down money being injected into this space, or everyone's moved their money? They wanted to move their money before April and now it's available, these types of opportunities. What do you think is happening there?
So are you saying it might change the sort of population growth forecast?
Not the population growth. I was just talking about capital coming in, because there's two things, right? There's the population growth, but there's also capital coming in the door to purchase these assets. So, yes, you got population, but yes, you got capital looking for a home, which, historically some countries – your money's not safe. They can just reach in and take the capital out of your bank account. But if you look at the laws in Australia, you know, property is pretty much like a bank. I hate to say it, and look, everyone knows it, but you drive around Sydney Harbour at night, you know, and look how many lights are on those multi-million dollar, $10, $15 million apartments, right? What you got, like, you know, it's 20 stories high and you got literally four levels on lights every single year. It's just essentially people just been land banking assets. And it's just there's been some very interesting changes to policy that's happened this year regarding, you know, foreign investment. I was just wondering, if you think that the restrictions on foreign investment for the next 2 years is going to have a major impact on these assets, or has the money already come in and it's not really a problem?
I think my view is that particularly with what we're seeing in the US and the tariffs, and there's a lot of global uncertainty, I think Australia will continue to be seen as an attractive place for foreign capital to invest in. We've got a stable government, rule of law, and we believe in a rules-based sort of trading economy. So I think the foreign capital is definitely looking, continues to look at Australia as a good place to invest, particularly with what's going on in the US as well. So that's been a discussion I've had with a number of property groups, and that's what they're seeing. So increasing interest in Australia as a capital destination.
That's very interesting. It's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen in the next couple of years. So with the cutting of the interest rates, I know we just covered it, with the funds and your targeted returns, if they do proceed to cut, you know, two more times, what impact will that have on potential returns for the strategy?
So that cap rate or yield that I talked about of our indicative portfolio, 5.7, we believe that reducing interest rate environment should actually tighten those yields, so those cap rates. As you know, cap rate or yield is kind of the inverse of a price earnings multiple. So as the yield comes down, essentially it's like expanding the price earnings multiple. So essentially, that dollar of income that the property is producing will be worth more potentially as the yield sort of tightens. So I think it's a positive. It's a positive factor going forward.
Since you've been speaking to a lot of other groups and a lot of people looking to invest, and a lot of colleagues that are looking to back you in this new fund of yours, what's some interesting questions they've hit you with that I haven't covered?
I think probably there's one question that some people say, well, it's our total return is 8 to 10%, and we've got sort of a waterfall diagram of how we make up that return. And in our, it's not a forecast, but it sort of works through. Essentially, that total return of 8 to 10, let's say it's 9 in the middle of that band, we sort of think over the next few years we'll deliver around about a 4% income return and around 5% capital growth. So some people say, well, the income return is lower than, let's say a syndicate, which could be, like an office building in Canberra that's 50% geared, or that's showing a 7 or 8% distribution yield. Well, the key difference is that because our fund has higher quality properties with lower gearing, it will have a lower sort of initial income return. But we believe that total return of 8 to 10 is a much more attractive risk-adjusted return than essentially buying a single property which you've paid stamp duty on that's 50% geared. It's there's much less diversification. So I think people get their heads around that, about how the return profile differs to a high yielding type property, and when they understand that, they sort of realize that our return is of a very high quality. So that's one question that people ask about. Probably the other question is around liquidity. And as you know, with unlisted property, there's no silver bullet for liquidity. However, we believe that the fund, which is monthly unit pricing, quarterly distributions, we believe the fund has, and we're basically saying we believe we can deliver 5% of NAV per quarter on a reasonable endeavors basis. And how we get that is, how we arrive at that is there's a number of what we call layers of liquidity in this fund. The first layer is the underlying funds, the institutional funds, they often have liquidity windows. So every sort of 5 to 7 years, they basically say to investors, do you want to stay in the fund or do you want to roll over? Because they're open-ended funds. Let's say if you're let's call it UniSuper, you got 300 million in one fund, you might choose to redeem 50 million because you want to rebalance to something else, or you might want to take more in that fund. So there's these liquidity windows that are coming up in many of the funds we're targeting. Some of them have liquidity every 12 to 18 months, you can get out some of it, or some of them have a limited sort of quarterly levels of liquidity. So it just depends on the underlying fund. So that's layer one of liquidity. The second layer of liquidity is that these funds have essentially what you call secondaries. So investors can sometimes buy or sell interest in the funds, even if those funds aren't raising capital. So again, in that example, let's say AussieSuper has 500 million in one fund, it might want to rebalance 100 mil out of that fund into something else. So there's this process of buying and selling secondaries that occurs. Then we've got the third layer of liquidity in our fund, which is a small listed property portfolio. We're probably going to be targeting the lower end of 10 to 20% in selected REITs. And the REITs will be not necessarily the property developers or the fund managers like Goodman Group or Charter Hall, more the rent collecting REITs, because that's what our fund is. Essentially, it's a core rent collecting, property product. So we'll be focused on rent collecting REITs that also complement the portfolio. So there might be REITs such as childcare or self storage or Bunnings warehouses or convenience retail that kind of balance out our portfolio and provide more diversification as well as a bit of liquidity. And then of course, once the fund is up and running, there could be hundreds, maybe thousands of investors. Some investors coming in on a regular basis. In a model portfolio, some investors doing DRPs. So we'll be able to sort of manage the liquidity through there. So when you layer up all those levels of liquidity, we believe that the fund offers a good level of liquidity for what we're for a fund of this style. And that's the way we've designed it.
That makes a lot of sense. So if we didn't cover it already, PanGen is open for a raise right now. Do you want to cover exactly, what their offer is? What's the deal? What's the timeline? What is happening, please?
Yeah, no, thank you. So we're currently raising funds into our first close as we speak. We think there's some good opportunities to deploy in the near term into some of these great funds that we're talking about. And I emphasize that that the fund is targeting some of the best quality institutional grade funds at a very attractive pricing point in the cycle with good long-term property fundamentals in structures that essentially there's minimal transaction costs like stamp duty. So there is a potential to be accessing some of these funds at small discounts to their book as well. Although I'd be buying a lot of these funds at book value at the moment, given their sort of attractive return outlook. So yes, we're raising we're currently raising to launch the fund or establish the fund in June, ideally, with deployment in mid to late June or possibly early July. But as I said, once the fund is established, then I believe it can become it goes into the next sort of growth stage of the fund, where we will look to list the fund on the big platforms such as Hub or Netwealth. We'll get it rated with a rating agency, because I've had many discussions from financial planners who say to me that, Ryan, this is a wonderful fund for our clients. It's conservative, it's high quality, it's monthly unit pricing, it's ongoing. It's a sort of a perfect model portfolio type fund for a lot of their clients. They need to get it listed. And, we think that the scalability of this fund is significant. The underlying funds that we're investing in is $60 or $70 billion of equity. There's plenty of secondaries that are available, plus some of the funds are raising equity. So we would hope to grow this fund to be hundreds of millions and possibly billions of dollars in size, which I think that scale will be really great for investors. It'll allow us to negotiate great terms with managers and essentially continue to deploy into great opportunities.
If any of our listeners want to learn more about PanGen or yourself, or get in touch with you directly, what's the best way for them to reach you?
Absolutely. The best place to start is on our website at www.pangencapital.com. The information memorandum is there to download. We've got a slide pack. We've also got webinars that we hold for people who'd like to get a quick introduction into the fund. And of course, you can contact us. Our contact details are on our website as well. So more than happy to talk to potential investors or financial advisors or family officers, and we'd love them to be a part of the fund's initial opening, because I think I'm really excited about this product. I think it's offering something genuinely new to the Australian marketplace. I mean, professionally, I'm really passionate about this product. I'm putting my heart and soul into this, and a lot of my own funds into this, along with my joint venture partners. We believe in the product. We believe in the timing, and we think it's going to be a wonderful product that'll produce good, steady, solid, risk-adjusted returns over the medium to long term. And I think it sort of goes back to my philosophy about long-term investing. When I was at UniSuper, we were investing people's life savings. And we are thinking about it from a long term. And that's why we came up with the name PanGen Capital, which essentially means pan-generation capital. We would love to be, we would love our investors to be investing with us over the long term for their lifetime, and perhaps pass on their investment to the next generation. So that's really our philosophy.
Ryan, thank you very much for coming on the podcast, The Rate of Change with York Wealth Management. Really appreciate your insights today, and I love what you're doing about helping people provide access to institutional grade opportunities like this. So thank you very much for coming on, and I hope you have a great day.
Okay, you too. Thanks. Bye.
Any use of this recording does not represent the view of any other third party and are the sole personal opinions of the speaker. Any reference to financial products does not constitute advice or recommendation, and before any action, you should seek proper advice from your financial professional. Australian listeners should head to www.moneysmart.gov.au to find more information on obtaining financial advice. To get in touch with York, head to our website, www.yorkwealth.com.au.